Thanks for listening to Stokely and Zach On Demand. Before Zach tells us who is moonwalking in the Hall of Fame today, have you subscribed to our podcast? Subscribe everywhere you get your podcast or at 1043thefan.com.
Getting you set for the biggest game since Super Bowl 50. Sunday night showdown between the Broncos and Chiefs at Arrowhead. Live from Lake Street Tavern, here's Stokely and Zach.
God, we are here. You don't have to think about it. It is right here. It is right now. How you doing today, Mr. James Merrillat?
I am doing great. Zach, how are you?
Man, I'm doing so good. It's Friday. It is a beautiful day in the Mile High City. There is so much going on this weekend. From a football standpoint, college football championship weekend tomorrow.
Starts tonight, actually.
Starts tonight. You got Baylor and Utah, right? Baylor. I'm confusing the uniforms in my head. Oregon and Utah, these two teams just played 2 weeks ago. Utah blew the doors off of them.
When Oregon was third in the country with everything in the world to play for.
And they got cracked something fierce.
38-7.
Yes,
I believe.
And I was a heavily investor in Utah that night.
I was the other way around.
You were the other way.
Unfortunately, I was in Nevada for that weekend.
Oh, that's right. That was
and
your
that
Vegas
was, trip. That was part of my Nolan Arenado in the playoffs. I just kept swinging and missing all weekend long.
On a Friday, getting it started, landing a shot. I love it. I'll tell you, and this is, once in a while I'll say, hey, this line stinks. This line smells like a glass of milk that has been left out in the sun. For a team that just beat the other team, what did you say the score was?
38-7. Yeah, that game was in Utah, but still, I mean, 38-7, it was a rout.
That was like 15 days ago, okay?
Yeah.
The spread on the game is 2.5.
Utah, I assume?
Utah is favored by 2.5 after beating the same opponent 38-7 2 weeks ago. This line smells like a corpse to me.
It does, but these games, now these are not quite like a bowl game, but kind of. When there's nothing on the line, they're really hard to predict.
Yeah.
Is Oregon going into this game of, hey, we want revenge because they derailed our season, or is it, does it really matter because we're not playing for what we thought we were going to be playing for? You have no idea of knowing kind of what's going through these kids' heads. I do think this, though. Pac-12, I believe they moved this game to Vegas, which is really, really smart because they used to have it in Santa Clara when CU played in it.
Oh, that's right.
It was in Santa Clara.
Like people didn't care.
No, and if when the Buffs went to it, it's always on a Friday, and you find out the Saturday before that your team's going to make it. In 6 days, are you going to, move heaven and earth to make a trip to Santa Clara?
Right.
No.
Right.
But can you talk yourself into it for a trip to Vegas to go watch your team? Sure. That was a stroke of genius by the Pac-12. Very smart move.
Well, it sounds like, and we don't know exactly how these things are going to shake out, but the winner of this game is likely going to the Rose Bowl on New Year's Day. So, I know what you meant, but there is still something on the line when it's the Rose Bowl. The Rose Bowl still rings kind of different.
Yeah, it does. It does. So, okay, now that you say that, I'm going to go with Oregon in the revenge factor.
You know what? I think I am too. Like, why is that the way that it is? It's fishy, and I'm going to pull up where the public's at here in a second. Did you watch that game last night, Cowboys Saints?
I did. I caught I caught most of it. Caught the second half. Caught most of the second quarter after kids' basketball games. And Taysom Hill. I don't think he's as good as Tim Tebow. That was my takeaway. Like, why is this guy continuing to get playing time, get starts, get huge contracts, which his contract situation is maybe the oddest in all of sports. He's redone it like 7 times in the last year. But he continues to get opportunities. Watching that game, that's what kept going through my head of like, and I'm not saying Tim Tebow was a great quarterback or even a good quarterback in terms of being a pure passer, but he's as good as Taysom Hill. Like, that guy can't play.
I think Taysom Hill's better. I think that we're maybe a little bit prisoner of the moment, being how bad it was last night. I think Taysom
Hill, I don't know.
I think Taysom Hill's a naturally better thrower of the football. But look, I understand what you're saying. I'm not going to, you know, defend Taysom Hill. Last night he was 19 of 41 for 264 yards. He did throw 2 touchdown passes, but he doubled that up in the interception department. 4 interceptions. And here's my thing. Here's my thing. And those numbers, by the way, are inflated because he threw that 5-yard pass with 2.5 minutes left in the game, and it turned into a 75-yard
correct
garbage time touchdown. And thank God it happened because I'm on the live line plus 10.5, and they lost by 10. Let's go!
Some of us with the over started getting nervous. That game was 20-10 with like 4
minutes
left.
I know. one of my biggest takeaways was like Dallas struggled to finish that game. Like, they turned over the Saints 4 times, and the Saints were still in the mix in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just got questions about the Dallas Cowboys and who they are. I know they're a lot, they have the glitz, they have the glam. I don't know about the meat and potatoes on a down-to-down basis.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, they obviously the game against the Broncos, they looked awful. They went into Kansas City. I think that was a 19-9 game, kind of ugly.
Yes, you're right.
They put, you know, their offense came back on Thanksgiving Day and looked good against the Raiders, but they lose that game. So they have not had a good month or so, and they've just been up and down offensively. So I'm with you. I don't know that I buy that team either. If they weren't the Dallas Cowboys, if that was the Cincinnati Bengals, mm-hmm. nobody would be excited about that
right.
team. But because they're America's team, the glitz and glamour, as you mentioned, they get a lot of hype. I do think Micah Parsons is a heck of a player.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, I said this 2 weeks ago, mentioned it last week, mentioned again earlier in the week. Like, the kid is a shoe-in for the defensive rookie of the year.
No doubt. Like, he could not play another game, and I think he'd still get it.
I agree with you. Stokely and I had that conversation off the air because Stokely has a season-long wager that he was going to win it at the beginning of the season. How much of a favorite is he? At last time I checked, last week, he was minus 750, meaning that if you wanted to bet him to win Defensive Rookie of the Year right now during the season, you would have to lay $750 down to win $100 back.
Yeah, he's, I mean, a prohibitive favorite, and for good reason. You watch him last night, like, he was the best defensive player on the field.
He was. And maybe the best player on the field regardless of position.
Yeah, and when I talk about it, people take that as I'm knocking Patrick Surtain. I'm not, and I've said this since the day of the draft. I think Patrick Surtain is going to be a really good player. I think he's going to play here for a decade, but he was a luxury pick. Micah Parsons is a game changer every single week. That's what happens when you're inside linebacker. It's harder to do that from the cornerback position. Champ Bailey was here for a long, long time. He's in the Hall of Fame. The only time he was on good teams is when he had Peyton Manning and when he had Jake Plummer. Otherwise, he was only able to do so much.
Right.
It's just it's an odd position that way. And for the Broncos, who've been searching for a middle linebacker forever, to pass on Micah Parsons, never mind the quarterbacks they passed on, but to me that was a miss because I think he transforms your defense. Patrick Surtain, great player, potentially great player, really good player right now. I don't know that he can transform your defense. That's why I think it was a swing and a miss by George Payton on draft night.
Well, Parsons was flying around last night, sideline to sideline, had a sack, big play. And I'll tell you what, Dan Quinn came off pretty well last night. Dan Quinn is going to be a coaching candidate. We've talked about him, potential fit here in Denver, Colorado. Tyler has pretty much advocated for the hiring of Dan Quinn. And, you know, you got Mike McCarthy in health and safety protocols. Dan Quinn comes in, and I thought, just from a natural human standpoint, forget the numbers and all that stuff, I thought he came off well, and you can see the relationship he has with his players.
Yeah, so there were 3 takeaways from the game for me. One was that Taysom Hill's no better than Tim Tebow. 2, that, man, Micah Parsons is a great player. And 3, I'm watching that, and I'm going, I could buy that guy as the Broncos head coach. Just his enthusiasm on the sideline and the way he was engaged with his players. Like, contrast that to Vic Fangio. Mm. You never see Vic Fangio talk to anyone. I don't even know that his headset is on most of the time. Like, he just is so aloof and disconnected and just The one time he showed enthusiasm down in Dallas when he pumped his fist on the fourth down stop, like everybody went nuts because we finally saw
some
life.
Did. I pulled my phone out, recorded it, and tweeted. I'm like, is this Vic? Is this fired up Vic?
So one time in 2.5 years, and you contrast that to what we saw out of Dan Quinn last night. And look, I get it. The rah-rah stuff, it can wear thin over time and all that kind of thing. But, man, like, it's a game of excitement. It's a game of passion. And I think your coach has to instill some of that. I just loved what I saw out of him last night. I thought he did a good job managing the clock, which
he did
down the stretch in the first half, which people were giving me a hard time on Twitter about the Super Bowl and all that kind of stuff. It's like, that wasn't a clock management issue as much as it was play calling. But I was like, man, a guy who can manage the clock and show some enthusiasm, sign me up. I'd be on board with Dan Quinn.
Well, I thought he came off well. You and I agree on that. We will shift gears here as we are live from Blake Street Tavern, the Big House on Blake, 18,000 square foot sports bar, and it's awesome. 69 high def television, endless amount of beers on tap, an awesome menu that I'm about to tap into myself here during a break. All right, James Marilat from DenverFan.com filling in for Brandon Stokely today. Stoke will be back on Monday, and there are some new developments in the Broncos ownership saga that we'll take a dive into coming up next.
It's a Bud Light Football Friday. Bud Light, official beer sponsor of the Denver Broncos. Getting you set for the biggest game since Super Bowl 50. Sunday night showdown between the Broncos and Chiefs at Arrowhead. Live from Blake Street Tavern, here's Stokely and Zach.
There are some new developments in the Broncos ownership saga. James Marilat from DenverFan.com filling in for Brandon Stokely today as we are live from Blake Street Tavern here in Lodo. If you're anywhere in the area, you want to stop by, say hello. We are here until 2 o'clock. There's some new developments in a Broncos ownership saga. James, according to multiple reports, the Broncos have interviewed at least 4 different bankers about handling a potential sale of the Denver Broncos franchise. Broncos spokesman Patrick Smyth declined to comment to the report, which was released by Sportico on meeting with bankers, and said that the team is, quote, currently, quote, not for sale, end quote.
Sure.
Which is absolutely hilarious. We'll get to that in a second. Smyth cited earlier comments from team CEO Joe Ellis that team ownership will be addressed at some point after the season finishes. Okay, it sounds like from even your one little noise that you made there that you and I are on the same page with this one. A couple things here. One, Patrick Smyth, spokesperson for the Broncos, head director of public relations, has a job to do, and obviously this is a mandate for him to say. Simultaneously, it is flat out hilarious to say that the team is currently not for sale, because of course the team will be sold here any day after the season ends. And as Stokely and I talk about this stuff, like, you know, you're talking about a nearly $4 billion acquisition, and it might be up to $4 billion. These things are handled in the shadows, not in the headlines.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'll take it a step further. Like, the Broncos may even know already who, in fact, is going to buy this football team.
Maybe. I would think, though, we would hear rumors. I would think something would leak out. Like, it is odd to me that it's December 3rd and we haven't heard a peep about anybody that's really interested. Like, there was kind of the made up stuff about Jay-Z and Jeff Bezos and some of those kind of things. But, like, nothing from Schefter or somebody that was reputable, so that's odd to me.
But I will say this, and not to cut you off, Peter King did report that there is like 4 guys. This was like a month ago. Said that there was like,
but no names.
No names. There was 4 guys, but I would have to imagine like these guys who are worth, if you're willing to spend $4 billion on a football team, you're probably worth, I don't know, upwards of 10, maybe more, whatever. You don't handle business, you know, at the forefront.
No. And, okay, so I get that. But it also, though, you know, when we start looking at, hey, this team has to make decisions potentially about their coaching staff at the end of the season, and everybody says, well, they couldn't make a decision last year because they didn't have an owner, and they didn't, like, well, that's not going to change by January 10th when they'd have to make a coaching decision potentially.
Right.
This thing is going to drag drag into the offseason, well into the offseason. I think the first owner's meeting in the offseason is in March, so that's when they could vote and approve a potential new owner. That even seems quick to me to put together a $4 billion transaction, but I am encouraged that this news is out there, right? Because if they're talking to bankers, that means there are things going on behind the scenes. It's not as though these conversations aren't going to start until the season is over. It's going on. They're talking to people. They're positioning themselves. They're not talking to a banker because they need to raise the money. They're the seller. But you got to figure out, what are you doing with $4 billion?
Right.
Right. Like, that's not exactly easy to just, you know, put into your Robinhood account and call it good. So I understand why they would need to do that. I think it is an encouraging sign that things are heading in that direction. I will say this, though, about the ownership thing. First of all, I think that's a cop-out when everybody says that, oh, they're not doing things because of their owners, and that's part of the problem. Like, Joe Ellis, for the most part, runs that team just like Pat Bowlen did. He was around him for, 25 years? Mm-hmm. Like, he knows how Pat Bowlen wanted to run it, how Pat Bowlen did things. I don't see a discernible difference between the way the Broncos operate now and 22 years ago when I worked there. I don't. It's kind of the same thing. Now, the on-field product is vastly different, but back then it was, we want to be number one in everything we do, right? Not just on the field, but the game program and everything else. They still do all those things. It's still a first-class organization.
It is.
It's not they don't cut corners like the team down the street here, like the Rockies. They don't do those kind of things. They don't have, cups and T-shirts roll out with the misspelling of Tulowitzki because they don't want to pay to reprint them, right? So I think that's a little bit of a cop-out.
They don't have Patrick Smyth doing the laundry.
Right, exactly.
Remember that report from The Athletic that had actual executives and scouts and stuff doing the laundry?
That is an organization that cuts corners. The Broncos aren't that. About the only thing Joe Ellis can't do that Pat Bowlen could have done was overspend. Right, like when it's not your money and it's not your asset, you have this fiduciary responsibility to run it, and you can't just, put him in the red. That would be irresponsible. So that's about the only thing he can't do. And it does worry me a little bit that we haven't heard any names. Not that we as a fan base get any say in it, but like from a being comfortable with this standpoint, I'm a little more comfortable with the devil I know than the devil I don't know. Like, there are some bad owners in professional sports.
There are.
I think there's a bad owner or two in this town. I think about the only team that isn't owned by a group or a person I don't know if their heart is in the right place in terms of wanting to win, is the Broncos. I can't imagine if that organization, too, was run by someone who it was all about the bottom line first. That would be disappointing. So I'm nervous about how this whole thing's going to go on. Most people are all excited. Oh, they'll finally get an owner. Like, that's going to be some, magic potion that's going to all of a sudden turn them into a winner. I don't see it that way because I put the ownership thing way down the pecking order of issues with that team, and it actually is a bit of a concern for me of who it might end up being.
So I disagree with it being down the pecking order. I think it's massively important. If you get the right one, you could feel the ripple effect of the right one for decades to come. Maybe 100 years, as it stays in the family, the way that Pat Bowlen intended, the way that the Hunts, are in Kansas City, et cetera, Jerry Jones.
Or you could have somebody you can never get rid of, like Dan Snyder in Washington.
So, and that's the other side of the coin. That's the very real, not risk, because you have to do this. So it's not like you're either turning it down or welcoming it. Like, this has to happen. It's not staying in the Bowlen family. It will be sold. And you just hope that the league, Roger Goodell, the other owners, have wisdom in who the next owner is, because they have a real say in it as well. So, if you get it right, if I think the Buffalo Bills got it right. Buffalo Bills were
the
bad
Pegulas,
forever,
sure.
and Terry and Kim Pegula coming by it, and you just see the ripple, trickle down effect that is very real. Could there be potential downside? Absolutely, from someone who doesn't want to spend the money, from someone who meddles too much. But this thing's happening, man. Like, it's happening.
It is. And it could turn out to be a good thing. I'm not trying to just be pessimistic about it. Like, you mentioned the Buffalo Bills, and I think that's a situation that is similar to here, right, where Ralph Wilson was one of the founders of the AFL.
He was.
Worth a lot of money on paper, But from a cash standpoint, like, his biggest asset was the Buffalo Bills.
Right.
Same situation here. Like, Pat Bowlen and now his family are worth a lot of money, but the Broncos are their asset. That's how they make their money. That's how they pay their bills at this point. So cash, we have heard that a lot in the past of, hey, it's a cash poor team. I don't buy that with an NFL franchise. They basically have money trees in their backyard. Like, it's a bit of a cop out, but they don't have he doesn't have the same kind of assets and the ability to pay signing bonuses as every other owner in the in the league. If a guy comes in and spends $4 billion to buy a team, he's got plenty of dough. So that won't be a situation. To me, though, it's all about you want somebody who's not coming in because they want to be a part of the club and they want to be cool or whatever. It's they want to win. You got to have a guy that wants to win. That was the number one thing Pat Bowlen had going for him, is that he didn't care. I mean, obviously he wanted to make money and all those kind of things, but atop the list was winning. You can't say that about every owner. You can't say that about every owner in this town. You can only say it about one.
Well, hopefully a guy who comes in and has the billions to spend has done a lot of winning and wants to do more of it. So we're going to continue to follow this story. It is a massive story. It is coming to a head after many, many years this offseason. All right, it is a massive football game awaiting the Denver Broncos on Sunday night, live in Kansas City, Missouri. The whole world will be watching. And what is the taller task? To slow down on Sunday Night Football, Travis Kelce or Tyreek Hill? We have some very relevant numbers to bounce off of you coming up next.
It's a Bud Light Football Friday. Bud Light, official beer sponsor of the Denver Broncos, getting you set for the biggest game since Super Bowl 50. Sunday night showdown between the Broncos and Chiefs at Arrowhead. Live from Blake Street Tavern, here's Stokely and Zach.
What is the taller task on Sunday night, Travis Kelce or Tyreek Hill, to slow down for that Broncos defense? I have some interesting stats I want to bounce off of you here, James. And James Merrillat from DenverFan.com filling in for Brandon Stokely today. How about this? In 13 career games against the Denver Broncos, Travis Kelce has 83 receptions on 118 targets, so pretty good percentage there. He has 1,115 yards and 5 touchdowns in 13 games. That is incredible. That bears out a per-game average against the Broncos of 6 receptions for 86 yards every single game.
I believe it. Honestly, I would have believed if it was higher. And I'm surprised the touchdowns is only at 5.
Same.
Because it feels like every time the Broncos play the Chiefs, Travis Kelce is in the end zone. So I would have guessed that was closer in 13 games, closer to 13. I would have guessed he was averaging more than 100 yards a game against the Broncos. So he's been a Denver killer. He really has been. I mean, we've talked a lot in the last couple, 3 years about how they can't cover tight ends. And, yeah, they had their issue with George Kittle back in 2018 in the first half of that game out in San Francisco. And they've had some issues with Darren Waller. But I don't really remember like a Darren Waller game where it's just like, man, they couldn't stop that guy. It's really a Travis Kelce issue. Mm. They can't stop Travis Kelce, and they play him twice a year. So it seems like it's happening all the time. So I'm surprised those numbers aren't even a little bit higher. But when you put it in the total of more than 1,000 yards against one team in 13 games is pretty remarkable.
It is, and 86 yards per game, if you were to prorate that over the traditional 16-game season, you're nearly a 1,400-yard receiver.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the type of success that Travis Kelce has had against the Denver Broncos. But when it comes to Tyreek Hill, a equal threat, and I am lifting this quote from Cecil Lammy. He's got a great piece on DenverFan.com, The Three Keys to Victory, and he says, quote, in the games where an opponent has had the most success, its wide receiver Tyreek Hill is, excuse me, let me start over. In the games where an opponent has the most success, it's wide receiver Tyreek Hill that is limited due to an opponent's game plan. In the 4 losses for the Kansas City Chiefs so far this season, Hill was never the leading receiver. Hill had 3 catches for 14 yards in a loss against Baltimore, 5 catches for 56 yards in a loss to the Chargers, 7 catches for 63 yards in a loss to the Bills, and 6 catches for 49 yards against the Tennessee Titans. Notice how Hill did not catch any touchdowns in any of the four losses for the Chiefs this season. He's, Cecil goes on to say, advanced data and film study will show you that if you limit Tyreek Hill, you give yourself the best chance to win against the Chiefs.
Look, the numbers back it up. I do think that's a little bit of just, hey, when they've played poorly offensively, he hasn't had a very good game either. But I guarantee you in those same games, it's not as though Patrick Mahomes played really, really well and Travis Kelce had big games. And the only person who struggled was Tyreek Hill, and that's why they lost. Like, I think that's connecting dots that maybe shouldn't quite be connected. But it's sort of like, well, pick your poison. A tight end typically is going to be death by paper cut, right? It's just working their way down the field, 7, 8, 10 yards, getting first downs, moving the chains. Tyreek Hill's the sledgehammer, right? It's the big play, especially at home when the crowd then starts going and it gets everything riled up. Like, I get it, but if the Broncos limit Tyreek Hill, right, if they decide, hey, we're putting Pat Sertan on him and he has 2 catches for 10 yards, do you think that guarantees that the Broncos are going to win?
No, of course
I don't.
Not. Of course not. But it's a trend. I think it's a fair trend to point out.
Yeah,
from Cecil's standpoint.
It's a fair trend. I just don't know that that's the only reason in those games that the Chiefs lost was because Tyreek Hill didn't have a very big game. I think it's kind of a byproduct of the fact that in those games their offense just sort of sputtered. And when they sputter, their big play guy is probably not going to have much of a game.
We, they say if you don't know your history, you're doomed to repeat it. We have been looking back on the 11 losses to Kansas City that lead us up to Sunday Night Football. And in the latest installment, it's Bloody Thursday.
October 7, 2019. Bloody Thursday at Mile High. A new year, a new coach and quarterback for the Broncos. As Vic Fangio and Joe Flacco took their turn at snapping a Kansas City winning streak that now sat at 7. In an image not for the faint of heart, Flacco was physically annihilated against a Chiefs defense that pummeled Denver's offensive line to the tune of 9 sacks.
Second down and 9 here for the Broncos, down by 7. Ball is out there for the Chiefs, and Ragland takes it in for the touchdown. Knocked out by Hitchens. And without Patrick Mahomes, the Chiefs defense has let us take it into the end zone.
However, on this night, it was Kansas City's quarterback that wouldn't finish the game as a knee injury sent Patrick Mahomes to the sideline. And journeyman Matt Moore, just weeks removed from coaching high school, into the action at Empower Field.
Moore steps up, floats it, behind the defense, he is gone for the touchdown, no flags.
It was a nationally televised beatdown, encapsulated by the poetic words of Troy Aikman.
This is about as bad on offense as I've seen. I'm shocked there's as many people still here at the game.
Bloody Thursday demonstrated to the entire nation two teams clearly headed in opposite directions. Does the streak end Sunday night? It's the biggest game since Super Bowl 50. Broncos, Chiefs, Arrowhead, this Sunday.
Okay, so I have to admit, I have enjoyed these way more than I thought that I was going to. Because they stir up things that you totally forgot.
Yeah.
He said, Matt Moore, fresh off of coaching high school football.
Weeks before.
Dude, he was a part of a dynasty at Hart High School at the Santa Clarita Valley. He went from coaching that team to quarterbacking the Chiefs. And if you remember, Mahomes got knocked out early in that game.
Yeah, the dislocated kneecap.
Dislocated kneecap. There was real concerns whether he would like come back that season, I remember at the time. The Broncos got started early in that game. They went down the field and scored. There was a penalty on the extra point. They decided to go for 2. They don't get it, and that was their only points of the game as Matt Moore and the Chiefs won 30-6. It was the least amount of points the Broncos have ever scored in a primetime game. It was the most amount of sacks that they have ever give up in any single game with 9. And Troy Aikman said, I can't believe how many people were still there. I was not one of them as I left in the fourth quarter.
Me too. Now, to be fair, one of the sacks was on Colby Wideman.
It was.
On one of the worst designed
so bad
fake punts of all time.
So bad, so desperate.
Like, hey, we're going to put a guy on the field that's not normally out here. Red flag number one. We're going to run him in motion. Red flag number two, right? So that was the takeaway from that game. That was the moment I was officially out on Joe Flacco.
Mm.
I remember being at camp And maybe it was because we were coming off of Trevor and off of Case. And watching, like, Joe could spin it. Joe has a pretty good cannon. And so watching it at camp, like, man, there's somebody actually throwing the ball with some zip. Like,
yeah.
It was kind of a nice change. To be honest, when you go down there and watch Peyton, you weren't seeing a guy throwing with zip either. So it had been a while. And I was kind of, all right, let's see how this goes. Early in that season, right, they go down, he leads them down the field against the Bears. They get the two-point conversion. You think they're going to win. Didn't score a lot of points, but it was clutch. And then Vic's defense gives it up, and they lose the game. Like, he staked them to a lead against Jacksonville. He staked them to a lead against the Colts later in the year. Like, you were kind of thinking maybe there's something here. He was so flatline Joe that night. Like, had no heart, no inspiration. Big game, and he got out-dueled by Matt Moore. I was out on Joe Flacco after that one. But also listening to these, especially the most recent ones, it's why I think it's preposterous that if they go in there on Sunday night and they win, people are going to forgive and forget with Vic Fangio. Like, that was a Vic Fangio game. You got beat 30-6 at home by Matt Moore in front of a national TV audience. I mean, it was one game ago, Zach, that I wrote the column for DenverFan.com of in 42 games with Vic Fangio as the head coach.
22 embarrassments.
20 embarrassments.
Yeah, 20. And they were all embarrassing. We went through them.
And that was what we just heard was an example of them. So, like, we're going to forgive all that if he has one good night. That's preposterous. We may have to have him put together, like, these vignettes for all the Fangio embarrassments so we don't forget between now and January 10th so this team will do the right thing.
All right. Broncos country may inadvertently get something that they have been asking for in recent weeks. Asking ye shall receive on Sunday night, maybe? Take a dive into it next.
Getting you set for the biggest game since Super Bowl 50. Sunday night showdown between the Broncos and Chiefs at Arrowhead. Live from Blake Street Tavern, here's Stokely and Zach.
There are some in Broncos country that have been wanting to see more and more of one particular Denver Bronco. And inadvertently, they may get what they want this weekend. James
so it's
Barrett,
not the Bronco I want to see more and more and more of.
The Bronco you want to see more and more of is Drew Locke.
Correct. Correct. Okay. Now, that's just going to add to the myth that I am a Drew Locke guy. I just want to see more of him. I want to find out. I want to know what we have.
How on the heels of everything that you have said, how could you then say you are not a Drew Locke guy?
I'm not. I don't know that he's going to be a very good quarterback. I don't. I want to know. I just am not in the camp of virtually everybody else who, after 18 starts, knows for a fact that the guy can't play. I'm not in that camp.
Don't you have a hunch?
No, I don't.
You have a hunch that he's going to be good.
I think in the right situation with the right offensive mind, I think he could be really, really good. I do. Like, if I was a quarterback desperate team and I had a good offensive coordinator, I would take a shot on Drew Locke.
It's not crazy. It's not crazy. And I'm not going to make you sound crazy for saying it, okay? I saw some good things from Drew. I saw more bad things than good things, unfortunately.
I don't disagree with that.
And I think that I can't believe we're having this conversation again, but but here we are. As a second-round pick, Drew Locke got as much opportunity as anyone as a second-round pick as I can remember. Draft status, unfortunately for Drew and many others, maybe including you, is a part of the equation. And for a second-round pick to come in as the plan, that's rare in itself. To be the plan for a whole season. And unfortunately, that season was 5-11, and it was really, 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 really bad quarterback play.
I get, well, in part. I mean, it was not good quarterback play on a week-in, week-out basis. It was inconsistent quarterback play. I will just say this. It was an odd year that everybody else gets a mulligan for except him. Right? Pat Shurmur did. Vic Fangio
Pat
did.
Shurmur doesn't get a mulligan for me.
Well,
Vic Fangio
but
doesn't
he's
get a
still
mulligan
here.
For me.
They're still here. Like, Vance Joseph got fired after that kind of a season after 2 years like that.
Sure.
Vic Fangio got another shot at it. All I'll say is Trevor Siemian got 24 starts. He was a seventh round pick.
But Trevor Siemian played better than Drew did.
Yes. On occasion, games here and there. We also did a vignette where he was 17 of 43 and threw three picks in Kansas City.
And like, that's why he lost his job.
I get it.
Like, they both lost their job the same way.
No, he also lost his job because Trevor Siemian never had a moment like Drew Lock had against the Chargers where he led a comeback in the last minute of the game and won it on the final play. He never had those kind of moments. He could manage a game. Trevor Siemian was Teddy Bridgewater. That's what he was.
He wasn't as good as Teddy Bridgewater.
Teddy Bridgewater's 6-5.
I understand, but
Trevor Siemian was 13-11. That's like the same guy.
I just disagree. I think Teddy Teddy is a better quarterback than Teddy Bridgewater. What am I talking about? Teddy is a better quarterback than Trevor Siemian. We are going down a rabbit hole.
I know. Who do we want to watch? Who do we get to see? I got us off track. Sorry.
It is all good. You're passionate about your guy. That's your guy. Melvin Gordon did not practice yesterday. Fangio said he'll be 50-50. We'll hear from Vic a little bit later this afternoon, but he said he's going to be 50-50 up to play on Sunday. Now, Mike Boone and DeMario Crockett will serve as the backup running backs if Gordon can't go. But a lot of Broncos country has been wanting to see, myself included, more of Javonte Williams. I think he looks terrific as a first-year player, and I think we may see a heavy dose. Even if Melvin plays, we could see a heavier dose from Javonte than we have seen to date.
Yeah, no, and put me in that category as well. And I was saying it before the trade deadline. When they traded Von Miller, to me they should have traded Melvin Gordon. And at that time it was the Titans that had just lost Derrick Henry.
Yep.
Seemed like a place where it would have made good sense. Like, Melvin Gordon's a good player. Melvin Gordon's actually had a pretty decent year.
He has had a pretty decent
year. He's had a couple of fumbles, and they've been at bad times. And, you know, for whatever reason, I think a lot of it's Philip Lindsay. He's not popular in this town, but he's had a good year. He's a good back. He's going to go somewhere next year and be very productive.
I think that the genesis of the dislike for Melvin, or really the disapproval of him being here, is the price tag. You're paying him top 10 money, and I'll admit, he's a good player. Had a good year last year. Second half of the season was good. He's good this year. He's just not great, and to pay that position.
I get it, but they're also a team that the last 2 years has been $20 million under the cap. Paying Melvin Gordon hasn't prevented them from spending money on someone else, right? It's not like, oh my God, they would have had this, this, and this if they weren't paying Melvin Gordon. They're under the cap. They decided not to spend that money. It has nothing to do with Melvin. They got to pay somebody. But anyhow, I thought they should have traded Melvin Gordon because I think Javonte Williams is going to be a really good back. Like, you and I have this ongoing argument about it because you say he's great and special.
I say he's really good. I didn't say he's great or special. You keep on twisting that. I said he looks like he can be a special player. We don't know yet until the sample size gets bigger.
Okay.
I want to see the sample size get bigger because I'm really encouraged by what I see.
And I want to see him be the bell cow. I want to see him get the ball 20, 25 times every single game. That's what I want to see. He's been great as a platoon guy and sharing carries and getting some rest and then coming back in. Like, he's been really, really good in that role. But can he do it week after week after week when he's the man? I think so, but I want to see it.
You do think so?
Yeah, I think he's going to be Mike Anderson. I don't think he's going to be CP or TD, but apparently that's, you know, just ripping the guy. I think he'll be really good. I'm excited to see it. I think Pat Shurmur and Vic Fangio are going to get the Michael Malone treatment on Sunday. They're going to have no choice. They're going to be forced to do what they should have done all along and play Javonte Williams and give him a ton of carries. Because, look, that's the recipe for going into Arrowhead and having any sort of chance is you have to run the football. You have to have Patrick Mahomes standing on the sideline.
No question.
You have to dominate time of possession. So that should have been their plan anyway. Now I think they're going to kind of be forced to have that be their plan. I'm excited to see what Javonte can do on Sunday night.
All right. You know what the thing with you is? Is like a lot of times when you isolate your opinion, it's normalized. But the way that you say it and deliver that opinion comes with so much extra color. Like you saying what you just said right now doesn't sound like the guy that said, if you're going to go buy a 33 jersey, save your money. Like, that doesn't sound like the right guy. But you get to the destination, but you are
how do I say it?
Yeah, what are you trying to say?
You know what
Zach?
I'm saying? Like,
no, I
like
get
you
it.
Don't sound like the guy that said what you said, and I forget
and
the other
if you're
line.
You're gonna go buy a Javonte Williams jersey for Christmas for someone, save your money. That's what I said. I still believe that.
Which is hilarious.
How many people you see
walking
around?
Because you said you're excited about him.
I am.
But that doesn't sound like a guy who's. I mean,
how many people do you see walking around this town with a 38 Anderson jersey? Not a lot. It's a rarity. Because he's just a guy that was like, oh, yeah, he was pretty darn good for a few years. He's not a legend. He's not up on the facade at Mile High. That to me, when you say great and special, that's what I look at. And to me, if I'm going to drop $100 on a jersey, it's got to be somebody that's like, you know what, I'm going to wear this even after the guy retires.
It's going to be timeless.
Right.
Right.
That's all I'm saying. You take it as a knock. I take it as very practical.
All right. Speaking of the Broncos offense, can this side of the Broncos ball hang with Mahomes and the Kansas City Chiefs? We're going to play our Friday staple, fill in the blank, offensive edition, coming up next.
Miss any of Stokely and Zach? Make sure to subscribe to our on-demand podcast. You'll get every episode as soon as they're released. Just subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or at 1043thefan.com.